CITR 101.9 FM. That was Lavender Diamond with Open Your Heart from the new album. What's the name of the album? Imagine Our Love. Yes. It's a very sweet song. I'm joined this week by the drummer of Lavender Diamond, Ron Reggie Jr. Reggie. Why did I say Reggie? Reggie. I just like confirmed it like 30 seconds ago. It's Reggie, right?
That's right. It's Reggie.
It's Reggie. There's something wrong with me. So this is Ink Studs, the radio show where we talk about comics, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Colin Upton.
Hi.
Esquire. And we're located at CITR.
Esquire?
Esquire.
What does that mean?
It's actually a term for lawyers, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So sounds we can...
Sounds classy.
So, not only is Ron a drummer in this fantastic band, but he is also a fantastic artist with such great titles as Skibber Bebye. Did I pronounce that one right?
Yes.
Skibber Bebye. The Wakefield, which is part 13 in the Yeast Hoist series. Yep. Yeast Hoist, best title ever.
Oh, thank you. Talk about, before we got on the air, you were talking about comics that the ladies don't like. They don't, no lady wants to pick up a book called Yeast Hoist.
No.
No, they're not.
They're
like, what's your new book, Yeast Infection? Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah,
I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. Just by walking close to it, you get an uncomfortable, the not-so-fresh feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ron's, you're a bit of a staple in the alternative comics community. We've been chatting for the last while about our interest in comics and love of all sorts of comics. So we're going to talk about your comic history and your music and all sorts of fabulousness. So, let's start with comics, Colin.
I'm actually quite curious about what comics inspired you and what your background is in comics.
Let's see. My background in comics, I think I've always been in... I'm one of those people, like, I always knew I wanted to draw. I never wanted to do anything else ever since I was a little kid. And I always liked comic books, and I think kind of had the idea that I wanted to draw comic books, but when becoming an artist in high school and stuff like that, and getting into punk rock and discovering like weird art and stuff like that, this was the like early to mid 80s. Comic books really didn't seem very interesting to me, you know, and it wasn't, I remember, you know, I like would read the Ninja Turtles and I would read American Flag and I would read those kind of, you know, those, the things that seemed, you know, that seemed a little bit more interesting. I was reading that stuff, but I was like 15, 16 and I was losing my interest in kind of like science fiction and fantasy and stuff like that. Like it just was wearing off. I mean, I was still interested in that stuff, but I was just looking for more as an artist. And I just, one day I was in the comic book store and there was a cut, you know, and I was like, had just started listening to Black Flag and stuff, and there's an issue of Love and Rockets with Hopi, with Hopi on the cover. And right next to it was an issue of Neat Stuff with Girly Girl on the cover. I think it was like, that would have been Neat Stuff like 2 or 3 or something. Mm-hmm. And that, I kind of just turned and like picked up those two comics, and then that was it. Drawn Corley and Fantagraphics. I was like kind of 15 or 16 when they, both of them kind of like first started doing stuff. So I really was just following all that stuff from there on in. Probably Chester Brown is probably the most, I don't think it shows that much in my drawing, but probably in constructing comics. I remember getting the first Vortex issues of Yummy Fur and mm-hmm. noticing that they were reproductions of Xerox things, and I was like, wow, that's a really good idea.
You hadn't seen mini comics at that point?
No, because that would have been like 85 or 86, and I hadn't really seen any, and I was like, oh, I should try and do that Xeroxing mini comics. That's a good idea. And just the fact that he was doing kind of like artistic stuff that was really weird was also really interesting to me. So when I graduated, I grew up in Massachusetts, southern Massachusetts, and went to school in Boston. And as soon as I needed to get a job to pay rent, I got a job at a Xerox shop and started making mini comics. And so I was going to art school and making mini comics kind of at the same time, and kind of having the facilities to use all the Xerox stuff. In being in art school and trying to just do the weirdest stuff I could, I just started making the kind of like most creative mini comics that I could. I kind of came to comics as a way of kind of like trying to do it as a, I think because it was an art, like trying to approach it like a fine art. And I really spent a lot of time thinking about like all the different elements and what I could do to find my own voice in you know, like where I put the words, what the shape of the page is, what color it's in, what how thick the book is, how what size the page was. And at the time, I was kind of feeling like I really feel like the Hernandez brothers are a good example. I was so interested in their stuff, but their artwork seems to be within the, like a lot of cartoonists, yeah. They're working within the page, and what goes outside the page isn't necessarily as integral to the work. You know, like what kind of paper. I feel like they're working on.
They're kind of set with a set
they're
parameters.
Set, they're set within the parameters. They're not necessarily creating like books. And I was more interested in like the book art of what paper was on, how thick the paper was, all that kind of stuff, right from the very beginning. And that kind of helped me like find my own voice in comics. And at the time, it seemed like there wasn't that much stuff that like I looked at that I thought was really like well designed or well like put together. And the way that things have progressed over the last 10 or 15 years has been exciting to me. Now, a lot of times I'll get when younger people hand me mini comics and stuff, they're always they've always thought about all this stuff. And I don't know, that was interesting to me.
No, it's quite neat. I went to SPX and I bought this one mini comic off a kid, and it was burnt. He'd like burnt the edges of it. And I thought that was so neat. Mm-hmm. It was like this weird like pirate story. Mm-hmm. And it was just such a neat way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's, you know, I can't stick it with my other things or else everything's going to get covered in charcoal. But, you know, it's in a bag on the top of a stack of books, but it's still really neat. And it's like really like people really trying to step out of the thing.
Well, I see that as sort of a convergence of the small press mini comics and the art book traditions. You're seeing a lot of that now.
Yeah, you are seeing a lot of it now. I'm excited about it. I always thought it always seemed really obvious to me. Mm-hmm. But I think it took a long, with everything with the art world and the comics world kind of coming together, has kind of taken a while, you know.
Now, you're speaking of the, you know, the contrast or the commonality between art and comics. Now, your staple in the Kramer's Ergot anthology, Volume 6, is currently on stands in finer comic book stores.
Yes.
Colin's holding it up for both of us.
The story in the new one actually was done in 1996.
It
hasn't been published until now.
Part of it, I think, of that one was published in a SPX Expo anthology. Am I right?
Or was that? Yes. Well, these first two pages. There was like a version of a story that involved these first two pages, but nothing from this specific.
Okay. And.
Some of it appeared in a Scottish anthology in 96.
Wow. Like
the last four or five pages of it. These pages.
We're looking at pages in with... it's actually quite an interesting story. With that story, we'll discuss that one a little bit, because it's neat, because there are certain parts to it. Now, you did each part at a different time, but they all kind of work together as a whole?
Yeah, kind of. I did the ending part first and did the beginning after that.
And this was earlier in your career where you're still like kind of working with the page, because it definitely looks completely different as far as page layout to your newer stuff. And maybe if we're like looking, if we're able to look magically in the past at your a young Ron's mini comics, were you more working with the standard page setting still?
Not so much. I was always kind of, I mean, I was working in the kind of digester, like quarter page size books, because those are the easiest to make for a long time. This was probably the longest story I did before I did Skipper Bebop. That's why this was kind of like an in-between part in my career that had never been published. I've always been trying to do the thing where I don't put the space between the panels and draw the lines, which makes it nearly impossible to reformat my work.
I guess that's your experience of doing it yourself. You just kind of, you know, you know what you want.
Exactly.
And it must be different working with... I guess with Drawing Quarterly, where you've got, I guess, is it Tom that puts together the, you kind of give them the stuff?
Yeah, but they
work closely with you.
Yeah, they let people design the books as much as they want. I pretty much fully design the shape and the size of all my books. I think, like most publishers, they're willing to let the artist do as much as they want, but if the artist doesn't want to do as much of it, they'll take over and do some design stuff. But I pretty much design my books, like every bit of it.
Now, going back into design, I'm interested in, you're talking about art school. What did you take in art school?
I was in the illustration. I started out, it's funny because I wanted to make rock videos. I started college in 88, and that was when they had, it's funny to remember, but they had just invented the camera that was all in one.
Yeah.
But they only had one of those at the school. They mostly still had the cameras that were the separate pack, and then the camera was a separate thing. That
we had one of those when I was a kid.
Yeah,
and cumbersome.
And so it was the technology. I did that for like, and to do that at my school, you had to be in the performance art department,
mm-hmm.
which was really kind of funny because I mostly wanted to draw comics, and I was kind of like withdrawn and didn't really want to perform. But I did that for a year, and then I went into the illustration department and went to school for illustration. The illustration department was not very comics friendly.
I was going to ask, yeah.
Not comics accepting? Friendly.
No.
They were not very accepting of comic stuff at all. It was really funny to me because I remember at the time bringing in, you know, my instructors were like, well, what are you talking about? What is it that you're interested in again? I don't really like, they had maybe heard of Crumb, but like, hadn't heard of him very recently at all, you know, and
they all have respect for Spiegelman.
I would not in the late 80s, not really. I mean, Mouse was out, but they weren't really, it wasn't, I don't think it had won. When did it win the Pulitzer?
92.
I don't remember.
Yeah, 92. So it wasn't out yet. Yeah, no, I would bring in issues of Raw and show my instructors this stuff. I'm like, see, it's really artistic and weird. And they're like, it was really funny because I just remember getting the attitude like, well, you know, these people are never, this stuff is, you're not going to get a career out of this.
Yeah.
And it's funny to look back because like now I'm sure if I went in on it, you know, now you're like, well, here's Burns and Pan. I think, well, that was before, when I started school, I think it was just a little bit before Pee-wee's Playhouse too. And like, I would show them the stuff and it was, none of those people had, a lot of the people that were in those early Raws are, I would, you know, they're all big illustrators. And now I assume that if you're in an illustration program now, you may be aware of Charles Burns. He's a pretty big illustrator, but at the time it didn't really impress anyone.
Fantastic.
But I just went along, just kept doing it anyways.
I when I was in art school, they sort of, when I brought up comics, they sort of thought I was some sort of mutated animator gotten lost.
Right. There was no animation department at the school, so they're like, well, we don't really have animation. So I don't know what you're doing. I don't know why. Make some illustrations. Draw more realistically or something.
Charles Byrne is never going to draw a jam jar label.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I wouldn't be surprised.
You guys have seen the Altoids.
Yeah, the Altoids.
Right? Do they have that in Canada?
Yep. They're in the comics.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, but he did have a bunch of Altoids.
Yeah, billboards. Most American cities have Altoids billboards by Charles Byrne. So that's pretty close to a jelly jar.
A lot of mainstream Marvel DC comics will have a full page ad by him, and it's a Charles Burns comic that ends with someone getting a breath mint.
Oh, I haven't seen those. Those sound great. I haven't seen those. I'd like to.
That's fantastic stuff. I think we're going to take a quick song break.
Yes.
I forgot what the next song it was.
How about Like an Arrow?
Like an Arrow. That was the one I thought it was, so I queued it to that.
Oh, great.
Once again, we're speaking with Ron Ricci. We're going to get more into the comics just after this. This is Like an Arrow off Lavender Diamond's new album, Imagine Our Love. Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver from UBC. That was Lavender Diamond, Like an Arrow, featuring the drums of our guest today, Ron Rigi. So we were talking about his comics, some of his history in comics as a young man going to art school, getting berated by his teachers for wanting to do these silly little doodle books. Well, you didn't say that, but that's what I just said. Now, your art style, it's quite... it's one of the more unique art styles, like a careful balance between some really simplistic imagery, but you also like to mix it with some really interesting stylized stuff, too. Mm-hmm. Is that something you've always been trying to do, like have a little juxtaposition there?
I guess so. I think it's hard for me to see. I think a lot of it's just evolved naturally for me. So for me, it's just the way I do things. I don't really know the difference.
I found the Wakefield was the one that really stood out to me the most, with the first half of that, with flying guys, I guess.
Yeah, that book's really kind of calm, and I have kind of like, I had, the time I was doing that, I just really wanted to do lots of landscape drawing and stuff like that, and have been interested in doing kind of like stuff from real life, so yeah, that's how that book kind of evolved. I was just wanted to do big, big drawings. So.
Now, is that your most recent...
Yes.
Book? Okay. Yes. I just want to kind of get a
came out last November, fairly recently, in the last November or something like that. Sometime in 2006.
And was in Skipper Bebop, that's the one you did while you were living in an art collective?
No, I did Skipper Bebop. I worked on it for more than 5 years. I also scripted it all out.
Oh, wow.
Beforehand. I kind of did Skipper Bebop kind of like a, probably how someone would do a film. I kind of scripted it out and storyboarded it all first and then executed it. But it took like 2 years to write and then spent a few years reading. But I did this one in, I was living in Boston for 10 years and I moved to the Bay Area. And I spent a couple months living on a farm in Northern California and worked on it there. That's where I did the bulk of all the drawing on it.
It's an epic book. It's over 250 pages, I think I'm correct.
It's over, it's, was it 300 and, no, 200, yeah, 250 something.
It's a pretty interesting story. It's kind of, I see it as like a look at like kind of a frustration with the expanding, we were talking about this earlier before on the show, the urban sprawl.
Yeah.
And it kind of seems like that, where it's like these, I don't know how to describe the mother-son.
Mm-hmm.
What are they?
Well, they're brother and sister.
Oh, they're brother and sister. Oh, I thought mm-hmm. it was...
Well, you know, it's not like I tell you. It's yeah. It's still a mystery.
It's still... you ruined the mystery.
It's a little bit... I mean, the book's pretty confusing, and I really like letting people read their own stuff into it. I love it when people come up to me and they're like, I really like the way that this is talking about that and makes reference to this, and I'm like, oh, I didn't intend it that way, but if you
but that's
read
great.
It... But that's great. That's good for you.
So, urban sprawl, is that just me, or was that something you were looking at just
definitely.
Kind of loss of nature?
Yeah, the book definitely deals with kind of, like, human society and kind of, like, the way of civilization, kind of like civilization versus non-civilization, I think is probably the... I mean, I did it all pretty subconsciously without really thinking exactly what I was trying to say, but it definitely has to do with my feelings of kind of, like, civilization versus non-civilization.
It's quite an interesting, it's you kind of take real life settings, like, you know, city stuff, mm-hmm. With human characters, and then these kind of not so human,
yeah, like kind of half human
things, mm-hmm. and just kind of like their reactions
to the, yeah,
to and the every, city life,
and every time they go into the city something bad happens.
Yeah. And it but it seems like it would be cutie, but it's not cutie. It's quite... It's very sad at the end. I won't ruin the ending for anyone. But, and are those reoccurring characters to you?
They were for a while, because, I mean, I kind of wrote all the different chapters a little bit separately and then spent a lot of time kind of, like, molding them and bringing them together. So for a few years there, yeah, they were kind of the only characters I was using to make stories. And there are a few other stories I've done since then, spatterings with those characters in them. I'm not... sure I'm through with them yet. I might do some stuff with them in the future. We'll see.
Well, I know the elephant appears in the Beast book.
That's right.
Put out by Fantagraphics.
Mm-hmm.
Plug, plug, plug.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous book put out. And in your picture there, the drog The elephant guy from Skibbereby. Well, when makes an appearance.
When I realized, because it was really hard for me to figure out what beast I was going to do, and I was looking at all these different ideas, and I was like, oh, what was it going to be? And when I came across that character and read what the beast actually was, I was like, oh, this will work really good with the elephant, because it's a beast that appears to people. What they wrote isn't everything that what's said in here doesn't explain everything about like the character. But basically, it's if you see this creature while you're on a ship, it's like a Norwegian creature. If you see this creature, he'll be a guy riding in half a boat with seaweed for a head. And if you see him, it means that you're not coming back, that you're going to die at sea. And then if you tell anyone else on the boat with you, then they will also, that you saw this thing, then they'll die too. Basically, you have to keep
How does anybody know that it exists?
That's the way. Or then there's also, I think that this creature exists in different folklore in different Scandinavian countries. I think it's actually, I have some Danish friends that I was talking to about, and I think it's a little bit different in different countries. In Norway, I think the creature has to do, like, you would, if you step on seaweed, or if you see seals have almost human faces. If you look like a seal close up, their faces look really, really human. I think it kind of comes from that, like, if you would step on a rock that the drog is on and then you see its face, it means that you're going to die at sea. And there's kind of different interpretations of it. When I was looking it up, it seemed like there were different characters. But, yeah, when I discovered it, I was like, oh, this has to do with dying at sea. And I was like, that has to do with the elephant character, so I'll draw him. It's been 10 years, but I'll...
And that's the thing, is, like, looking at that, it totally ties right in to Skibbereby.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it's, do you kind of see that there'll be something in the future where you'll find little parts just to throw in that will fit in into like an ongoing narrative?
Mm-hmm. And there's a few stories that are, I'm going to do some collections in the next couple of years of stuff that I've done. There's a couple Skibbereby stories that aren't in here, like Comics 2000. You remember that book? I did a Skibbereby story for that.
That was the association.
I was just wondering, as you develop your drawing style and your characters, it seems to me that it's almost like you're also not only developing your style, you're developing a vocabulary of characters and creatures and elements.
And noses and faces and kind of, the whole alphabet of stuff. I'm definitely interested in that, in the kind of like alphabet nature of comics. Of iconic usage of it. I think it's really interesting. I'm curious. I'm watching kind of like comic scholarship has gotten so, continues to get so more and more intricate. I'm looking forward to the big article about letter forms in comics. I mean, the letter D is a comic. It's so much more easier to notice in Asian writing when you can see that it's supposed to be a house and with an apple under it or something like that. But I mean, every letter that we do, letters are, they're cartoon characters. That's what they represent, things the same as Mickey Mouse represents a whole bunch of stuff. The letter R represents, and like the way that it evolved to be that way.
I think Scott McCloud just fell in love with you.
But it's really fun, and it's not like I want to design like letter forms, but like Garfield is a letter as much as Charlie Brown or Snoopy is, or the zigzag on his shirt. And I think it's interesting to kind of like think about that. And I don't do work strictly based on that, but I'm kind of curious.
That's really neat. The power of imagery.
Yeah,
definitely, and themes and
icon, kind of like the repeated iconography is interesting to me. So. And it's fun to just be like, oh, I'm going to draw everything from profile. Like, almost, I rarely draw people, like, straight on. And I have no, like, my characters had to be, like, a three-quarter view.
Well, you can't really get as many dimensions with a straight-on view as much, because you're just, everything's kind of flat.
Yeah. My stuff is very, very 2D, but I like it that way.
And we like it, too. Now, you're currently in an art show in Phoenix, Arizona, Uninked, which must be a bit of an honor to look at your grouping.
When Chris invited me to be with those other guys, I was just like, I don't deserve, why me? I don't,
It's
I was really, really honored to be part of it. It's
Gary Panter, Jerry Moriarty,
Kim Deitch, Chris, of course.
Does he actually have stuff? I thought he just curated it.
Maybe he just curated. I haven't seen it.
He put together a book for it, which looks, you know.
Yeah, I wasn't that aware of the book until kind of the final stages of it, and then he sent me a PDF of the photographs that they took of my artwork, and it's amazing. The show is it's non-comics art by cartoonists, so it's all paintings and sculpture.
Now, did you do sculptures?
Like, I did do some sculptures for it. I mostly did drawings and stuff like that, but I did do some little figurine people that I sculpted.
I think I saw the pictures of a couple of figurine people.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're kind of continuing the same look and style of your comic books.
Yeah, they don't have big noses with X's on them and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm really honored to be part of that show. It's really, and the catalog looks really amazing. I'm actually gonna not completely separate, but they invited Lavender Diamond out there to do a concert. It's not in relation to the show or anything like that, but we're going out there in July to play, so I'm actually going to get to see the show. I wasn't expecting that I was going to be able to make it to Phoenix to see it, so I don't think Chris is going to be able to make it to Phoenix to see it.
He's a pretty crazy guy, or busy guy.
Yeah, he's
crazy busy.
Crazy busy.
Crazy busy.
But yeah, I'm excited to go and see it, and I'm really excited to be part of it.
The neat thing for me looking at that for you is you're the young guy, it seems, in that group. I don't know much about Jerry Moriarty stuff.
I think Chris Ware is a year older than me, which is kind of funny because we're often like popularly put in separate generations.
Probably because you don't write about old-timey.
I don't write about old-timey stuff. And I think it took me a little bit longer to stop doing mini comics and get published by, you know, like my generation of cartoonists came a little bit after, like when he was doing stuff, you know, with real publishers. I was still doing mini comics for a few years later, something like that. So that is kind of funny.
But there's a definite difference between, say, yourself, mm-hmm. your experience, and like Gary Panter and Kim Deitch.
Oh,
who
definitely.
Are both, you know,
definitely.
You know,
yeah,
old timers in the mm-hmm. respected sense of experience.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Panter being a, like we said earlier, the Pee Wee stuff and lots
of
weird.
Well, Kim Deitch goes
and
all the way
Kim
back
Deitch.
Out to the underground.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. So. I mean, and his family is royalty as far as I'm concerned. Anyways.
Comics royalty.
Each one. I actually, when I was really good friends with Seth Deitch in Boston, the youngest of the three brothers. He worked, and he actually taught me a lot about underground culture. Seth did. Seth taught me a lot about his family. He taught me everything I know about animation. I mean, everything that Kim puts in his comics and everything about like their father's experience and everything. I learned a lot of that from Seth. It was really educational. He taught me a lot about old music and stuff like that. It was really
Have you ever seen Waldo?
Have I ever seen Waldo?
No,
I
mean, has he ever seen Waldo?
It's good. Good question, but I don't know the answer to. Oh. Perhaps.
Perchance. I think we're going to play another track.
Okay.
And what's the next track I should play?
How about Bring Me a Song?
What track
is it? The only problem is it's number 9.
Number 9.
I don't perform on this song, but it's my favorite anyways on the record.
Well, look at that. You know? You still love it, and it's a great track. So, Lavender Diamond, what was the song again? Bring Me a Song. The song, Bring Me a Song. We'll be back in a sec with more Ron Rigi.
Say my name. There's no one to blame. bring me a song.
Seattle 101.9 FM Inkstuds. That was Lavender Diamond off Imagine Our Love song. Bring me a song. Very lovely, very relaxed song. She's fabulous.
Thank you.
Her vocals are spindacular.
Thank you.
Is that a word?
No.
Oh, they are. She can sing very well.
Now, and she actually writes some comics with you.
It's true. The Awake Field is pretty much a collaboration between the two of us. She wrote one of the, because it's in the books in different chapters, and one of the chapters is a adaptation of a story that she wrote that I did, and then there's other writings of hers in there.
And the boys
mm-hmm.
is written by her as well. Am I correct?
No.
Oh no, that's mm-hmm. someone else. I thought
that's
that was
that's someone else. Yes.
Oh.
Nope, that wasn't Becky. That was another lady.
My research failed. Which is a fabulous story collected in the, if people are into checking stuff out, the Ivan Brunetti graphic mm-hmm. anthology mm-hmm. compilation. Now, getting down to Lavender. Oh, Colin, you got a question?
I got a question.
Yes.
I got a question.
Finger on the table.
The art question type thing.
Yes.
What do you ink with?
I'm one of those people that I still haven't found the perfect pen. I'm still looking for the thing that I like to ink with the most.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't found it yet. I tend to ink with, like, not microns, but micron-type pen, like disposable rapidograph-type.
Pigma-type pens.
I'm trying to find ones that are permanent. I can't think of which brands I like. It seems like it's always changing.
Sakura?
I find... Yeah, I have tried some of those, but I used to use rapidographs, but they clog up so much.
Oh, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I mostly use pretty cheap materials. My originals aren't always ready for hanging.
And your color work, is that done on the computer?
Most of the cover of the Awake Field is painted, but most of my color work is done on the computer. But I do like to do paintings, like the cover. Actually, this book that I'm like right here, The Awake Field, everything here is painted. There's no computer colored stuff.
It's quite fabulous. The inside pages, that just the other side of the cover there.
Mm-hmm. The end papers?
The end papers.
The end papers.
Colin's smarter than me. That's why he gets paid the big bucks for the show, and I get a carrot. Oh, sorry, I wasn't giving you the checks.
Oh, you're
hey,
you're owed a lot.
Straight.
A whole lot of nothing. So let's talk. We got about 50 minutes left, so we'll have a quick chat about Lavender Diamond, because you are currently on tour. You're playing Minnesota, I think.
We're playing Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
I know we played Vancouver last night, and we're playing Minneapolis in 3 days?
27th, I think it is.
Oh, that's good that you know and I don't. I have to look at this little piece of paper in my wallet here that says we're playing at the Cedar Cultural Center on the 27th.
There we go. Do you have all your tour dates?
I have all my tour dates here.
So do you want
to
read them?
From there, we'll be going to, let's see, Minneapolis, Chicago, Toronto, Montreal, Boston, Hoboken, New York, Baltimore, Philly, D.C., Carver, North Carolina, Atlanta, Austin, Denton, Texas,
everywhere.
San Diego, and L.A.
Hoboken?
Hoboken.
That's a real place?
That's a real place.
Hoboken.
Hoboken.
And so...
That's where Frank Sinatra's from.
Wow.
I do believe that is the most important thing about Hoboken, from what I've
heard. The important thing about Hoboken, yes. Other than the fact that you'll be playing there.
Other than the fact that I'll be playing there at the lovely Maxwell's, which I'm very excited to play at. It's a nice place. It's been there for a long time.
Nice. So if you listeners feel so inclined, I suggest going out and checking Lavender Diamond live. Very stripped down type show. Sounds like you guys are very minimal acoustic.
Yes. Yes, we don't have any amplifiers. We just have a piano, acoustic guitar, drums, and voice. So,
and you're saying your drum kit is pretty much.
Yeah, I just have a floor. I just have a floor tom and a snare.
Now, how long have you been hitting the skins for?
Oh, geez, probably about as long as I've been drawing comics. But I somehow decided to go in the visual art direction and concentrate on that more. But I've never had a lesson or anything like that, and I've been in a million bands, but most of them like never left the city that I was in or made a record or anything like that. I've been in a couple groups that made a few records. I was involved in a band called the Swirlies that did quite a bit, but I wasn't as involved in that band as I am in Lavender Diamond. So Lavender Diamond's the first band where like I'm a real member making real decisions about the band that's putting out albums and touring and doing all the proper music stuff.
All the artwork.
And all the artwork. Yes. I've been telling people recently who ask about it if I have any new comics out that I have a new comic called the 20-page booklet of the Lavender Diamond CD. So if you buy the CD and you're interested in my art, there'll be a lot on the inside that you can't see when you're in the store. But I did a drawing for every song and I hand wrote all the lyrics.
Oh wow.
There's a little essay in the beginning that Becky wrote that I all hand wrote out and stuff like that. So yeah, I definitely brought my artistic ideas to the band, which everyone seems to be very happy about. I don't know. It's nice.
It's an extra gift you bring to the table.
It's an extra gift I bring to the table. It's true. The band likes it. The labels seem to like it a lot. It's,
No more drummer jokes for you.
No more drummer jokes for me, I guess. I don't know.
Now, you guys are an L.A.-based quartet.
Yes.
And actually, is it four or five?
There's four of us. Yes.
I was unsure because of the piano.
That's what a quartet means.
Yeah, but sometimes... I'm going to throw something at Colin.
Hey!
There we go. Throws me off my train of thought. What are we going to do with you, Colin?
Yes, we live in Los Angeles.
Give me the money you owe me?
Everyone's going to think I owe you money.
You owe me money.
Oh, I do, actually, I do. And that was me being nice. Okay, so we'll get back into talking about Lavender Diamond instead of me and Colin bickering. So you've been also kind of keeping as much as you can involved in your kind of comics community. This involved with the music you played at the family store in Los Angeles, Sammy Harkham's
store.
Which I've been hearing nothing
Sammy
but
David Kramer's store. Yeah,
that's the
That's the Kramer of Kramer's Ergot, David Kramer.
Sammy is the guy that puts it together.
Yes. And Sammy and Jordan Crane have their studios upstairs above the store, so they've got their little, like, all studio away from home, the old-fashioned thing that when cartoonists used to get in their suit and go to work to work somewhere.
Wear a fedora, smoke a cigar, and a tie.
Have you ever had a studio, or do you always work at home? I've always worked at home.
I have a studio at home.
You do? Oh, great. That's, I do, too, but it's usually a corner of the living room or something.
Yeah. No, I gave up my bedroom.
Really?
To make he it did. Into a studio.
He's got a lot of little Wargamer guys that take up a lot of room.
That's in the living room.
That's in the living room.
Yeah.
Colin's very committed to his art. Put his bed out in the balcony just for it.
I was just wondering, is it difficult or exhilarating to go from working in a group in a musical setting to working on your own in a comics?
I find it really, it's really good for me because doing music is so, it's so social, it's so public, it's so performance oriented and everything. Whereas I've, you know, I specifically chose comics because I don't, visually, with visual art, I'm not that much of a performance or collaborate. Like, I like to work on it all by myself, and I like the fact that it's a silent, anonymous art form. I'm really into the fact that it doesn't matter how old I am, it doesn't matter what I look like, it doesn't matter where I live. You can read the comic book, you can be, you're experiencing exactly what I put on the paper, but it doesn't matter who I am, and that's really exciting to me. So I find the, you know, and when I work on comics, when I work on a book, I'm at home for months on end, barely ever going out, you know, to get all the work done. And it's so isolating and by itself that I love having the music thing to kind of go back and forth between the two of them. It's kind of fun. They definitely feed different parts of my personality, which is great. And they don't compete with each. They're both kind of like a vacation from the other one, which is really great. So,
yeah, I guess comic tours don't happen very often too. So you get to see the world
exactly.
much as you can.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. All the comic, you know, you can tour, you know, the comics tour has always gone on for Joe Sacco. You know, he's out in the world. He's doing something completely different. He's
doing a Finding in Baghdad.
In the green zone.
Could happen, I'm sure.
I don't think. I really hope Joe Sacco never goes to Baghdad.
Well, he just had a like a 10-page story in Harper's about
But
so he's been there.
It's worse now, though. Yeah. Every day it's worse.
Yeah, every day it's worse.
Yes. We're getting all sad. I'll let you guys know about some upcoming shows we are doing in the Ink Studs. And just before we get in close to our time, so I don't forget, next week we'll be joined by Scott McCloud. Speaking of Scott McCloud,
he's on tour.
He's on tour. He is. He is a man about town.
And he's taking his family with him.
Mm-hmm. Two kids, one wife.
Here's an interesting story about Scott McCloud.
Oh, Scott McCloud dirt.
He lived in Cambridge, and I used to Xerox the roughs for Zop.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
I was his personal guy.
Your go-to guy.
I was the go-to guy for Scott at the copy shop. He would come in, and if I wasn't there, he would leave the stuff for me and everything. And it was funny, because I was only doing little mini comps and wasn't really doing much at the time. And then, like, years later, I met him. And I was like, hi, Scott. And he knew I was, and he knew my cartoons. I was like, do you remember me? I used to make your Xeroxes. And he had this blank look in his face. And he's like, oh, that's, you did. Oh, my goodness. But it was fun. That was another thing. I learned. It was funny. I didn't go to Harvard or anything, but I learned a lot from living in Cambridge from different people that I met there. But Scott was one of the people that, like, you know, he would bring in, like, you know, he drew in Blue Line and stuff like that and all this kind of, like, stuff that people don't really do anymore. I got to see how Zot was made. He would bring in the pencils, and he would bring in roughs a few weeks later, and it was really interesting to see. And he's so in between the two worlds of alternative and mainstream stuff, too. It was fun seeing.
He's straddling the fence. That is quite interesting as far as, like, being able to really see progression in a story, because not a lot of people let you get that close into seeing their progress, but you get to see it just by some kind of accidental happen chance. So next week, Scott McCloud, you'll be at Sophia Books that night on here May 31st. Following week is John Porcellino.
Yay!
Yay! King Cat Collection from Drawn and Quarterly, which also released Ron's book, The Awake Field and Skipper Bebye. And a week after that, June 14th, Baron's Story. Fabulous painter from San Francisco who has influenced a lot of really big name current painting comic artists. Less alternative than the stuff we've been talking about today. A different style. And the week after that will hopefully be Eddie Campbell.
Wow. Terrific.
You're in great company.
Yay.
And I'm really happy you're able to come out and join us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's very rare we're actually able to have people in the studio, so the chance to be able to do it is fabulous.
Glad I was able to make it.
And we still have another couple minutes.
you're in the wrap-up phase.
Yeah, I am in the wrap-up phase.
You going to put on a song?
I am going to end with a song. What song would you like me to end with?
How about Oh No, which is the first song.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We said that, Oh No. Let's see how long that song is. I feel like I'm...
3-something?
347. 347. I think we're wrapping up.
Okay,
great. I think we're wrapped up.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming, Ron. It was definitely a delight. And if you want to listen further, inkstuds.com. And also check out Ron's work at lavenderdiamond.com/Ron. Check out Lavender Diamond at lavenderdiamond.com. You could listen to the album on MySpace.
Yes, you can.
I saw you guys have the full album on there, I think.
Not anymore. It was there for a few days.
When I left.
There's things going on with my band that I don't completely understand. Things like why it was on MySpace for a few days and then wasn't. But I think that had something to do with MySpace. So
there we go.
And some kind of relationship between MySpace and Matador, but we were on
the record company. I'm sure we have something to say about that.
Mm-hmm. It was great that they did it though, because we were on the front page of MySpace for 3 days. And when you do that, you start getting 200 friends an hour. It was crazy.
Kind of insane.
And it was crazy. And so they put the whole album up there streaming at the time that we're on the front page. And
okay. Well, there we go. You can still listen to four songs on the MySpace page.
You can actually listen to a stream of the record on our website. There's a stream there. Yeah.
So it's a fabulous record, Lavender Diamond, Imaginary Love, in stores now for Matador Records. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks.
And up next, Crimes and Treasons. Oh, there we go.